Wednesday, November the 19th, 1943. Thank God! Today is sunny! Hooray! Look, I shouted, kneeling and pointing a quivering finger aloft. The sun! I tell ye it's the sun! People say I's daft, but I tell ye that's the sun. I heard people in England say that if you see the sun, they report it to the police. Yes, yes, said Bomley Fuller. And that, he says, pointing, is a shovel. Start fucking digging. I realised, said Vic Nash, that with all the digging I've done out here, I must have changed the shape of Italy. Vic is short, about 5'5", looks Jewish, but isn't. He was a pastry cook in the Old Kent Road before the war, but now he's digging command post. Why didn't they put me in the Army Catering Corps? Well, you should have asked, said Bombardier True. I did ask, said Nash, in a note of exasperation. I said, look, I'm a pastry cook by trade. Can I go in the Catering Corps? Nash pauses, lights a cigarette. The sergeant said, of course, you're lucky. They need cooks in the auditory. So I thought I was safe, but now, fuck it, look at this lot. He held up a shovel coagulated with mud. We freeze as the sound of a plane is heard overhead. Whose are they? Where are they? They loom into view from the south. Boston, said True. Their engines are labouring under the weight of bombs. Above them and to the right are a squadron of Kitty Hawks. Americans! For Christ's sake, don't move, warned Edgington, or they'll have us all. They move majestically towards the Abruzzi Mountains, Jerry Flack peppering the air around them. It's astounding that so few planes get hit, said Deans, peering at the conflict with his right hand shading his eyes. Well, I said, it's very difficult for a shell and the plane to be in the same place at the same time. By the law of averages, it can't happen too often.
Ooh, ark at bloody Einstein, says Nash, tapping his head with his finger. I say this, the shell with your number on will get you no matter where you're standing. For all we know, there's one on its way right now to us. Understand?
I cupped my hand to my ear and leaned forward. List! I think I can hear it now. No, wait. No. It's not for you. It's for Mrs. Ada Grolix of Broccoli. Even as I spoke, a plume of smoke starts to trail from one of the Bostons. They've got one, shouted Ernie Hart enthusiastically. We all cheered. The Boston turned in a slow circle and started to head back to base. We watched as it jettisoned its bombs. The smoke was still trailing from its port engine as it passed into the distance in the direction of what must have been Foggia Aerodrome. I bet there's a few city underpants up there, said Edgington grimly.
Oh, and there's a lot of city underpants down here, said Nash, who hadn't been able to get a bath for nearly 10 days.
The Boston gradually diminishes into the nothingness of the distance.
Well, that made a nice little break, said Ernie Hart.
It sounded heartless, but things like planes on fire were all the real entertainment we had. If a lorry crashed in a ditch, the men would come from all over to see it pulled out again. Anything to break the boredom. There's a fortune waiting for the man who can invent portable holes. Edgington says this with a strained voice as he hurls a shovel of mud. There is a pause, and then I sing, holes, portable holes. They'd be used for all the troops, including the Poles. Yes, we need holes, portable holes. And I'm stuck for words, so Edgington continues. It'd save us all having to dig like bloody moles. He's stuck, and I continue. Shoveling lumps of mud is very bad for me. When I started, I was 6'1", but now I'm 4'3". The flow of the muse is interrupted by the dreaded Major Evan Jenkins. He walks with his torso bent forward at a ears-me-nose-me-arse's following angle. He looks at the hole. Why aren't you digging under a camouflage net? He said, his little beady eyes boring into our souls. The answer came very simple. We haven't got one, sir. Send someone at once to wagon lines and draw one. Yes, sir, said Fuller, but the inflection sounded like you bastard. Bomley Hart, take monkey truck and collect a scrim net. Hart grins. He offs, and soon we watch monkey truck pull away from the road. Jenkins is still trouble hunting. Have you got a track plan?
Yes, sir.
Where is it? Hurriedly, I invented the track plan. We keep to the edge of the drop, and when we reach the road, we turn right under the tree, sir. Is all he said. A track plan was this. So as not to leave new trails all over the landscape, we all kept to one path to draw less attention from Jerry observation planes. As the entire landscape was one great churned-up mud bath, it didn't matter where you walked or drove, as the water in the mud washed away all traces of the track. But to keep peace, we pretended. We watched him as he dutifully walked along the edge of the drop, keeping to the track plan that didn't exist. He did stop and pause once and look back as though he didn't believe me. Then he walked on. Fuck him. We continued combined digging and moaning. By evening we have a large, dank command post ready. First thing, the fire. After the addition of twigs and a tin full of dirt, whoosh, it ignites and settles down to give us a friendly warmth. We hide inside for a while as Ben Wenham fixes up the lights. Lazy buggers, he said, seeing us all huddle around the fire. Lazy buggers, explodes Edgenham. Where were you when the shit hit the fan? Specialists are coming in with their gear. Signallers are setting up their number 22 wireless sets, connecting up the batteries. Mr. Wright is duty officer. He ducks under our blackout curtain and surveys our efforts. Very nice. 10 out of 10. Ernie Hart has just come in with extra firewood. And what nice gunner is going to help bring in the Yule log? He throws the firewood in the corner. Yule log? Of course, my God, it would soon be December. The first one away from home. Out of the bloody way, says Shapiro, who backs in with the drum of Don 5 cable. Behind him comes Pinchback. They've been laying a line from the OP and are well covered in muck. Where would you like it, my lord? Said Shapiro. I point to a spot by the wireless. Pinchback is bearing the two wires with his pliers and with professional deftness connects the telephone and buzzes the OP. Shapiro watches, a cigarette between his lips. Pinchback buzzes again. A look of anxiousness on his face. The line isn't through. It means they have to traverse the whole bloody line again to find what's wrong. Pinchback smiles. Hello, OP? Okay, yes. Finally, what? You'll be bloody lucky. He grins and hangs up. Cheeky buggers. They want to know if tea will be served on the lawn. Who was it? I said, jam jar. Tea on the lawn, mocks any hunt. Where he lives, he hasn't got a bloody lawn. That is a truth, said Edgington, pontifically rubbing his hands together. Let's face it. Like us, he is a common or garden citizen. And, I added, as we haven't got a garden or a common, that's why we're in this bloody hole in the ground. Grab up! A voice from outside speaks and enters by pushing a dixie of hot stew, followed by a hand, and then a body belonging to Bomber Edwards. There is a mass exodus, but I am clutched by the arm. You stay and make like you're on duty, said Bomber Fuller. Bugger! I seek solace in a fag. Opposite me, left and right, sits in a wooden box reading a book. It made little difference if he was sitting on a book reading a box. It's all very cushy with the fire going. With headphones on, I'm wrapped up with the music. A tap on the shoulder. Turning, I see Ernie Hart. I've come to release you from your bondage. Oh, thank you. What's for dinner? It's M and V again. They must run out of that one day. The Batman and Stray Blaver have built a very fine officer's mess come billet. They have laboured this long day to achieve it. Woody, that's Jenkins Batman, tells us, next we're going to build a bloody hotel without water. November the 20th, 1943. The morning of November the 20th burst cheerily on us with an exciting cold downpour. Oh, gad, it was good to be alive. The question was, were we? We are concluding the finishing touches on the command post. There's a sandbag blast wall on the open side of the dugout. There are many brilliant minds at work in the war. Radar, infrared telescopes, Mulberry Harbours. But no bugger has invented how to get wet mud into a sandbag. We are almost pouring it in. When we seal the sandbag, the mixture starts to squeeze through the Hessian like thin spaghetti. Ah! We fill them to bursting, and yet when we lay another bag on top, it flattens like a wafer. Wonderful! This isn't a job, moans one miserable gunner. This is a bloody sentence. 17 battery tell us they have managed to fire 20 rounds in the afternoon. The bloody fool, said Gunner Files. If we all kept quiet, Jerry would pack it in and we could all go home. Gunner Birch is amusing his little mind by standing on the sandbag and giggling as it sprouts myriad growths of muddy spaghetti. Here, he says in a surprised voice. It's sexy.
Sexy? Says Bombardier Fuller. You must be bloody hard up for it if you get the Colin watching that.
Across the road, a battery of 3.7 let off a salvo of gunfire. The noise is such that all conversation is silenced. We start miming, and it gets out of hand. Edgington, Gunner Edgington, is caught in the middle of a very involved mime, standing on one leg and licking the back of his right hand.
I give up. What is it? I said. Ah, it's a one-legged man eating a toffee apple. Oh, you clever gunner.
We are silenced again by the 3.7s. While we cavorted in the mud, in the bright sunlit days of the Dodecanese, the British are losing the Greek islands to the Germans. It's all in the news in rather slanted terms. British troops, are fighting a, quote, skillful retreat on the Isle of Leros. HQ Middle East Command say, the more we delay them, the better it is for us. As we listen to this statement, the faces of the gunners break into wry, disbelieving smiles. Who are they kidding? It must be for home consumption, said True. My mother would listen to that and think we were winning. It was strange coming from him, because it was a fact that when True had sent his first photo of himself in Italy to his family, they wrote back and asked if we were losing. Bert had sent his photo back to his sweetheart, and she wrote back asking who it was. The worst was Gunner Collins. His family sent his photo back marked not known at this address. My mother, father, and brother had sent me a photo intended to boost my morale. When I saw it, I thought they were all convalescing from rabies. They were all white-faced, with fixed false-teeth smiles and staring eyes. The explanation was, it was taken by magnesium flash, badly printed, and the photographer, Mr. Weald, had asked them to open your eyes wide to get a good expression. The result was dead people standing up. Dean's Nash and Files have done a great job on their bivvy. It now has a fireplace, and so, in the evening, Harry and I go in for a warm. It was one evening, with the rain running in rivers, when we cooked up a tune, the Rockabanfina Rumba. From somewhere, I had obtained an ocarina, and, with edging and banging on a box of matches, we gradually bring alive a tune. It went like this. The rumba, Rockabanfina Rumba, a snappy little number, Rockabanfina Ray, oh, caramba, the natives say caramba, Rockabanfina Rumba, Rockabanfina Way. It was in the battery charts for about 3 weeks, but it never became a hit. Jamjar Griffin comes in. He's heard the music. Is this for all the actioners, he says, his bulk blocking the entrance. What a waistline. It came up to his armpits. It seemed wider than his shoulders, and when he jitterbugged, it appeared he was wearing a life belt under his jacket. Bloody Jerry officer at the OP. He said the war would last another 2 years. Well, I think he was right, I said. Oh, said Griffin. He's right, but it was the arrogant way he said it, as though he was personally making it last 2 years. I told him to bloody well where he got off. I said, we could finish the war tomorrow. We just kept it going so we could kill off as many of you bastards as we can. That's no way to talk to an officer, I said. Under the Geneva Convention, he could report you for swearing at a prisoner of war, and you'd be fined 10 shillings and a week to pay. Jamjar puffed up in anger. Swearing at him? He's lucky I didn't fuck him. I understood his feelings. Being at the OP is no holiday. Being mortared and shelled, along with infantry attacks, it starts to build up a sort of a hate. Whenever I was at the OP and saw any of our dead or wounded, I really felt burned up with rage. Having lost many friends in the fighting, it's very hard to take a passive view. Gunner Forrester just come in our tent and asked if anybody could read a letter to him. Edgington volunteer. The letter was addressed from his parents at home. Prepare yourself for a slight shock, said Edgington. From the borough of Ealing, rates overdue up to the month of July 1940, £3.18. If not paid within 20 days, proceeding will be taken. Forrest rode and snatched the letter. Fucking hell. A fucking rich demand in Italy. I don't believe it. Still no news of any firing. Rain, rain. Deans is in his cooking mood and about to hurl onto us a giant long flour and water pudding with curried cabbage inside. It was christened the Mongoid Monster. I think we're all bloody lucky. All this grub, steaming hot, tea, marmalade duff to follow, high-altitude chocolate. Edgington stops to poke some grub between his dinner manglers. Those poor bloody infantry lads up in the front. You're telling me, said Jamjar. The last OP, we could only get grub up by mules, and they were lucky not to be eaten. Oh, yeah, it's cushy back here. This, he looked around the humble interior. This, he said, this is fucking luxury. I was feeling in my pockets for a tin of mannequin shrewds that my father had sent in advance of Christmas. With a great gesture, I took the brown tin, opened it, and let their eyes feast on it.
Whoa! Cigars! Edgington shouted, and then, putting on his cross-eyed Ritz Brothers look, he took one with an old-worldly flourish, and with a new-worldly flourish, he stuck it behind his ear. The aroma after dinner was that of a London club after the port. We all felt relaxed, so we continued with our ocarina guitar and matchbox concert, this time others joining in on empty mugs and tins. We sang in the yard until 11 o'clock, mad midnight fools that we were. Harry Edgington is singing a song he wrote to his unborn child. Your mum and I, we spent a lifetime apart, and through the war years, we knew our heartaches, but that's over now, and you make your bow to your mum and I. We were all very moved, but not the 3.7 gunners behind us, who let fly a shattering barrage. That round up the concert. Good nights, good nights. In my damp roadside bed, with traffic a few feet from my head, I fell asleep and awoke with tar marks up my body. November 21st, 1943. My diary. Sunny early morning, rushed to hang blankets out to dry. Alf Files' diary. Began sunny, but developed into usual rain. Regimental diary. At midday, 19 battery reported, 2 guns ready for action. Bombard fired. Little improvement in the weather. Mrs. Cronk of Lewisham's diary. Cat died. Cancer milk. My watch points to the hour of... Oh, my God. My watch has stopped. Bombardier Sid Price. He knows about watches. Ah, you see, he said, mending it. You have to wind it up, you see, he said. That's silly of me. Down in our little valley, there's a small stream where women of the village do laundry. I approached one, who was only too glad to accept my chocolate ration to do mine. Her name is Maria. Everybody in Italy is called Maria. The men, the dogs, the chickens, the lot. With 2 guns nearly ready for firing, we're all back on duty. Monkey 2 truck takes a party up to the line to see if it's still there. I have a good look around the area. There must be 100 artillery pieces packed into 1/2 mile square. Ah! Bombardier Marsden is up with the rations. A mob I resemble around the tailboard of the 1,500-weight truck. Marsden and Dye Poole run the naffy issue. Dye was stone deaf. If you gave him 100 lira note, with 20 lira change to come, he would put it in the cash box and forget it. Repeated requests for change were met with deaf indifference. He must have made a fortune. After the war I saw him once at a symphony concert. A strange disease has shown itself. Diesel dermatitis. It's mostly among the drivers. Driver Kijel has his face covered in a purple dye. What is it? I said. It's called gentian violet. You look like a leper. Yes, I got a begging bowl in me cab. He was up from the wagon lines to help winch some of the guns into position. We're behind that village over there, he said, pointing towards San Dominica. This was where RHQ was, now ensconced in comfort. The dream of every gunner was to get a job at RHQ, usually in a house and thus home from home. At this moment, that skiddy bugger Evan Jenkins was in charge at RHQ in the absence of Colonel Scoresby, who had left to visit the regimental training area and visit the sick in Naples Hospital. Visit the sick, said Kijel. Who does he think he is, Florence Nightingale? No, I said, he's more like Florence Nightingale than the lady with the lump. Mick Ryan is calling. Kijel, never mind all that chatting. Come and help me get this bloody gun on the platform. Come inside, says Kijel, and waddles, yes, waddles the short ass away. Quack, 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 I shout after him. He doesn't turn, but raises 2 fingers behind his back. I'm laughing when a lorry passes and speckles me with mud. What's this? I'm on duty starting 11:30 and through till 2:30, along with Birch. Loaded with my writing pad, old Life magazines, and 2 Mars bars for my nappy purchases, I set myself up in the command post. Lieutenant Pride is there. Yes, his boot off, trying to hammer down a nail with a stone. We start firing at 0100, Bombardier, he said. On one leg, apparently, sir. If needs be, Milligan, yes. I would not stand in the way of a one-legged order, sir, I said. You know that. Bombardier Deans is doing various computations on the artillery board with a pencil that I swear is only 1/8 of an inch long. Who's at the AOP, I asked.
Lieutenant Walker, Nash, Griffin, and Bombardier Edwards. I'm afraid I don't know what the signals are. He cringes and said, "You won't report me for that, will he, young master?" Oh, dear. Trouble with wireless communications. Surrounded by mountains, reception is down to strength 3. I put up the extension aerial, but no go. We have to transmit by Morse code. I had a Charlie on the other end from HQ who sent this message. Reservisits. The rest of the day was a plague of these messages. One I just could not understand. He went, Kapalakan ekran vikani act MO, but Kapanachrikani ebalikum MO. Days later it came through in part 2 orders. Captain Levine MO to act for Captain Benty MO. But by which time it was too late for Captain Levine to act for Captain Bentley M.O., because he had fallen and fractured his bloody ankle. So we now had 2 M.O.s ill. At last, the biter bitten. Bentley had diagnosed his own illness as malaria, only to have another doctor diagnose it correctly as jaundice. Not to lose face, Bentley insists that the medical report states that he has malaria and jaundice. Sort of a malaundice. We had a brief spell of gunfire from A and D sub, a total of 10 rounds apiece, and then stand down. Bombardier Beaton from the gun speaks onto the intercom.
Hello, command post. We haven't had any overseas news today. Could we hear it this evening?
The reception was bad, I said. The latest news is that World War II is still on. How are the lads?
Well, pissed off. It weren't for Naffy today, we'd have deserted.
Never mind, it'll soon be Christmas.
Christmas? What's that?
2:30, Pinchback has arrived to relieve me. Pinchback and I had both lived in India and often conversed in Urdu.
Kitne baji hai? Sirf 2 baji, said Pinchback. Shabash, bilkul theek hai.
Lieutenant Price looks up. I think we have a couple of WOG deserters here, he says to Bombardier Deans.
Shall I search them for curry powder, sir?
Where is that Edgington? That Edgington is in a cave. A strange affair. The entrance hole is about the size of a man, but within we see the entire monkey crew spread around the commodious interior. He is, of course, clutched in his writing fever. He holds up his hand, a signal that I am to remain silent. He scribes on. I imitate a violin solo playing Hearts and Flowers. He is not amused. He is apparently in a self-hypnotic trance, where he could almost feel the presence of his beloved sweetheart, Peg. At the start of my music, he looks up with a strange sexual look, part Lochinvar, part Svengali, and part soldier. His lovely head bends to the letter as he finalizes it with a myriad kisses. Oh, Harry, you mustn't get yourself into these states, Gunridgeon. It's not good for you. You'll get lumps in your groins, and that can only be reduced by the cool hand of the Temple Maiden. Well, he finally deigns to speak. That's that. That is that, I agreed. And this, I point to my ear, is this. Also, I pointed to the fingers of my left hand. Those are those. He could not stay grim for long. He smiled. Ah, I said, there's a good boy, I said. Diddums is smiling.
Diddums will give Mummy a nice little kick in the cobbers in a minute.
Wait! He's a complete change of mood. Suddenly he says, I've got a new tune, mate. He hums the first chord to give me the key, then sings the melody, occasionally dropping in a few harmonic notes. Like all his tunes, it's beautifully melodic. The words he mused will be something like this. He sang, Remember how we kissed in the autumn? September turning green things into auburn. Didn't rhyme, did it? Never mind, he didn't care. It was World War II. I was never to hear the completed tune until the year 1956 at his home in Wood Green. I'm standing in the half-light of the cave, listening to Edgington singing his tune, when there enters one unromantic peddler palmer from Devon Shores, a true Erslum Burslem. Arr, marr, he said. Now, why a man wants to say arr, arr, is it beyond me? Where has the great Swede basher who says arr, arr been hiding, I said. The great Swede basher, he replies, has been getting his naffy. He starts to empty his pockets. Toothpaste, a new toothbrush, 3 bars of chocolate, a packet of Ridley's chewing gum, a packet of Beecham's powders,
a pot of Vaseline, and powers that be, a dozen pair of bootlaces. Well, he explains, after the war, there'll be a shortage of them, you see, and I'm not going to be caught walking around Devon with no laces in my boots. As there was no bootlace drought after the war, I can only imagine that Peddler Palmer now lives in a home crammed with World War II bootlaces. He could have started a panic. I mean, a man rushes into the dentist and says, there's going to be a post-war shortage of dental fixative. Men run out to start buying it to open post-war dental fixative shops and make a fortune. They would rupture themselves carrying kit bags and big packs bursting with tins of denture fixatives. Imagine the Germans. They take prisoners who appear to own nothing but sacks of dental fixatives. Hitler, dental fixative, hein? Rommel, ja, mein Führer. Hitler, it is a trap. Rommel, trap? Ja, eine dental fixative trap. Rommel, how does that work? Hitler, we don't know yet, but we soon will. I have arranged for the 14th Panzer Regiment to have all their teeth taken out and made mit the false choppers using the captured British dental fix mix. Soon we will know what the secret is.
November 22, 1943. My diary. Rain. Talk of special pits for guns so they can fire at maximum elevation. How exciting. Files diary. Terrible guts due to this prolonged tinned food. Strange. I didn't know our tinned food was prolonged. When did I last hear a gunner asking for a tin of prolonged meat stew? We now have a serious problem with wireless communications. And that is, we haven't any. Talk of putting out a halfway wireless relay station. Gunner Edgington's pubic appearance. Crabs! They've got crabs! The cry runs through the serried rank. The theys were the crew of Monkey Tuck 2. It was the first mass outbreak of crabs in the battery. How proud we were of them! At last, the label Dirty Bastards could be added to the battery honours. The only other mass outbreak of crabs was Gunner Neat in Bexhill. He told the MO he got them off a girl in Blackpool. I brought them south for the sun, sir, he said. Among the crab-ridden is Gunner Edgington. Let him recount the grisly details. We hadn't had our clothes off for some considerable time, much less our underwear. And, as I said, a bath was something we only vaguely remembered from a long time ago. My hair was a matted lump. All we knew at the time was to get phone lines out and keep them going. All else was sleep and food, and a good deal of the latter was often scrounged from strange outfits we encountered while out on the line. Not surprisingly, we began to smell strongly, and then to scratch. The irritation became incessant, and something obviously had to be done. I don't think Dr. Bentley came over to us. It was just arranged by phone calls that we go over to our HQ. I think there must have been more than M2 team, for the crab-ridden were taken in three tunnels to where some showers had been erected in the corner of a field. The showers were a Heath Robinson contraption mounted under a tin roof on angle arm supports, but they were thoroughly efficient. Captain Bentley, keeping a distance, called instructions from the safety of his room on the upper floor of an adjacent building. Strip off, he called to us. Have a thorough wash down all over, as hot as you can possibly stand it. In the middle of the field, in full view of civilians and soldiers alike, we disported ourselves joyously under four very efficient jets of steam and nearly boiling water to the accompaniment of screams, yells and crackles. Blimey, you can see the bloody things. You can see them moving on your skin, the little bastards. Sure enough, I could see my collection of the skin of my belly just above the short and curlies. Some 5 minutes, and Bentley calls out, "Okay, that's enough. Get up here like lightning." Away we went in a tight bunch for the steps which led up the side of the building, these being only wide enough to permit one at a time. It meant some of us had to ease back to create a single file rush up the stairs, all naked and freezing. Into a small bare room we thundered. Its only furniture, a bare table on which stood in a row seven empty cigarette tins and a large daub of cotton wool alongside, but no sign of Captain Bentley, though. Looking round puzzled, we saw his grinning face peering round a distant door at the far end of the room. He had no wish to get near us. The legends, crabs can jump 6 feet, still lingered on. "Right,
Each man grab a tin and a blob of cotton wool. Dip the cotton wool in the tin and dab it generously all over the affected parts. Now, quickly now, quickly.
He slammed the door in case any escaped. Looking in my tin, I saw a clear mauve liquid. The lads were all still chortling and crying in mock agony. Unclean, unclean, and ringing imaginary warning handbells. The fluid was liberally applied, back balls and bellies as well, not one of us having guessed what it was. It took about 10 to 15 seconds to act, then everyone's balls caught fire. It was raw alcohol. The first "Oh, mate!" was rapidly echoing all around, followed by a growl of "Oh, God, oh, bloody!" Faces were transfixed with pain and cross-eyed agony. They yelled, they screamed, they fell, they rolled, they jumped. They ran back and forth, they twisted, cannoned into the walls, into each other, they fell over the table. At the height of this chaotic fandango, I was sat on the floor, knees drawn up, right hand fanning my wedding tackle, when, through the melee of flailing arms and legs and prancing bodies, I saw the inner door open slightly, and Bentley's face appeared in the narrow gap. "Merry Christmas," he said, and was gone. For Edgington to remember that occasion in such detail 35 years after the event is quite a feat of memory. Mind you, you don't get crabs every day, not even at the fishmonger's. November the 23rd, 1943. "Milligan, files!" a voice of authority calls. It tells us we are to take 24 hours rations, drive to the top of Monte Criti, and set up a wireless relay station. "They say the reason for the bad reception is adverse metals," said Files. "Adverse metals," I said. "What are adverse metals?" "Fuck knows," he said. "Do you think it's the metal rings in the lace holes in our boots?" Files suggested. Adverse metals," I intoned repeatedly. "It's a lovely phrase, adverse metals." I phoned up the now crab-free Edgington. "Hello," he replied in an angry voice, obviously suffering from burning balls. "Is Edgington there?" "Yes, I'm here. What do you want?" "How's the old scorched scrotum?" "Oh, Christ," he groaned, "you should see him. They're going up and down like yo-yos." "Have you any adverse metals?" There's a small pause. "What?" I repeat the query. "Adverse metals." "Adverse metal," he chuckles. "I cannot tell a lie. I have no adverse metals, but I have a pair of bright red goblets." "Did they have any effect on wireless communications?" "No," he chuckled. "They aren't picking up any signals." "Then you can't have any adverse metals inside them." "That's very comforting," he said. "It's bad enough having them skin raw without lumps of metal inside." Files had put chains on the wheels of the truck. "Does he think they're going to escape?" We wave goodbye and take the road that travels round the rear of our position, skirting the foot of Monte Croce. We get onto a rough mountain road, slippery as grease. The road finally disappears. It's coming to something when a road can't get up to you. By steady driving, Files gradually makes it to the top. We pull up just below the crest. The slopes are slightly wooded with a scrubby grass floor. We look down to the valley at our gun positions behind. So skillful is the camouflage, we can see everything. Cautiously, we peer over the crest into enemy territory. The view is obscured by a drizzle and mist. Ah, comfort. That's the thing. Brew up. Hot water boil for dinner. Make up beds in back of truck. We stow our spare gear in the driving cab. After attempts are made to contact the OP, we have no luck. We report this to the command post. They say, stay up there on listening watch. We put the set to receive and put the earphones in a mess tin to amplify the sound. What was that place with the church, said Files. He's writing an email hole. It's terra corpo, I tell him. Freely translated, it means land body. Land body, he echoed. Yes, we were somewhere around the legs, the foothills, you might say. Ha 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 ha. It's night. We have our dinner in beds. The back flap is buttoned down, and with the light running from the battery, I'm smoking and listening to AFN Naples. The news is, French-Moroccan troops reinforcements have arrived in Italy, Japs resisting like fury in Bougainville. Tito's Yugoslav partisans are holding down over 20 German and Bulgarian divisions. By Jove, I said, it's starting to go away, I remember saying to Files. Laconically saying, it doesn't seem to matter which way it's going. We're still out here in the shit. It's remarkably peaceful on our mountain. The night has no sounds save the gunfire from the valleys below. The rushing sound of 25-pounders and 5.5 shells can be heard travelling overhead. We can hear mules and men. The mules win. They're bringing up rations for the infantry. I think they were the Royal Berkshires. I wonder who they thought we were. I thought I was Lance Bombardier Milligan, but I'd been wrong before. Once, back in Tunis, I'd been pulled up by the military priest who asked who I was, and I said, Napoleon. And they said, this way to the police station. I fall asleep, leaving Alf Files scribing away. In the dark night, the war went on. Being able to sleep peacefully, dry, snug and warm was, I suppose, a luxury.